Must be wonderful.
I mean, how did you first come across Eva?
Originally, and I can't give you the date, I went to India when before war broke out, and I got stuck in India for a year. And I came back to England very much impressed with all that I'd seen. And I had been a teacher before. I'd run a school. And it was wartime, and I had to find a job. At that time, I wasn't married, but I was living with Hugh, the architect husband with whom I've lived for 40 years, and he was in the army. No, he was interned. He was a German refugee.
Yes.
And Eva advertised for a joint secretary for these two organizations, the Association for Education in Citizenship and for the Family Endowment Society. And I applied and was taken on. And at that point, she was the principal of Morley College, and she was living in this wonderful house on the Heath in Wellgarth Road. And the, I'm just trying to think, the bombing was in process at that time.
It would be 1940, would it?
It would have been early, middle of 1940, I should think, something like that.
Yes.
And I worked from her home. And I worked for both her. I was appointed for and paid for by both her and Eleanor Rathbone. And I can't tell you for how long I worked with her, but I worked with her until the Ministry of Labour decided that I was no longer allowed to do this work, you see.
Yes.
Well, it was 2 years or something like that, but I remained close friends with her until she died, and with her family.
Did you?
And especially Rachel. And I lost touch with Rachel only recently because my marriage broke up in a very sad and tragic way, and I went through a very bad time, and then I remarried, and I haven't been in touch with many of the friends who belonged to
that period.
So at the time I was working with Eva, my husband had been interned, and then discharged and was in the Pioneer Corps, you know, the whole business, you see.
Yes.
So that was my own background, and I was living in a dig somewhere. And I was very happy to work with Eva because she allowed a tremendous amount of independence. And I was very interested at the time. I'd been a teacher, and I was interested in youth work. And so very quickly she allowed me to organize youth training courses at Morley College. So I did the two jobs with her and Morley College.
I see. So she has, it's a thing I've heard from other people, she has this capacity to delegate, doesn't she? I mean, she starts things off and then...
I started this off. She has the capacity to, she had the capacity to allow you to think of something and to develop it. On the other hand, one has got to recognize that Eva had a very strong personality. She hid a lot of her warmth under a bushel. Working with her was a tremendous experience. It was also quite a trial, especially since we were living in a very cold climate in her house, since she was always frugal, and she became more frugal on behalf of the war effort. We had no heating. We used to sit with hot water bottles. She used to dictate to me with hot water bottles, and I remember her fury.
What, with hot water bottles around you, or around her, or both of you? I mean, she
would have a hot water bottle. Occasionally she would have one, but she could tolerate all sorts hardships.
Yeah.
And she expected other people to tolerate hardships.
Yes, I see.
Have you heard that from others?
Yes,
too?
I have. Yes, it's all fits.
She was a very...
She was unconcerned about her environment, wasn't she, rather? And yet she has this artistic sort of side to her, about which comes out in the house, doesn't it, a bit?
Yes, but you're quite right. She loved the open air. She would use every opportunity to sit outside. And, of course, you know all about Trianon, which she and her daughter were terribly generous with, and I spent many holidays with my husband and my daughter down in Trianon, used
Did you
the cottage.
Really? Yes.
We would walk around there, and I mean, I was there both with them and alone.
But she used to swim, didn't she, and go out on walks and things.
But you see, she was absolutely unconcerned about her appearance or about what people thought of her. And for example, one of the highlights of my time with her was when she was going to Buckingham Palace. And she rang me up in desperation, said, "I've got one brown shoe and one black shoe. You must either bring one or the other." And I rushed up to Buckingham Palace with one black shoe and one brown shoe. Now, surely, is that a story that you've heard?
Oh, yes, this is absolutely fits with... I haven't heard that one, but I mean, I've heard very similar things, you know. She has also this sort of tremendous capacity, which I think Rachel brought out, for seizing opportunities, doesn't she? I mean, if there's a marvellous sunset, she'll say, "Drop everything and come out and have a look." Yes, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes. And yet, you see, while she did have this, she was sort of oblivious of people's feelings very often. And one of the things, again, which I'm not sure whether you ought to use or not, was the time when Coventry was bombed. And Rachel was living in Coventry at the time, and Eva was worried about Rachel. And Eva rushed up to Coventry because the telephone lines had gone. She found the house was standing, and she rushed back again. But she didn't go and see Rachel. I mean, she knew that Rachel was all right, and that was enough, but that Rachel might have suffered and been comforted by knowing that her mother was up there.
Yes, that's interesting, yes.
That sort of thing.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how one... She had a difficulty, I think, in feeling, in empathizing with people. She had a great capacity for empathizing with the masses.
Yes, she's rather like Beatrice Webb in that way. She,
yes.
I mean, yes, it's most interesting. I don't think anyone said that to me. When you say she's good at getting on with men, isn't she? Which of course a lot of feminists aren't. I mean, she works well with men politicians and people like that, doesn't she?
Yes.
I think it's difficult for you to say.
This is difficult for me to say, but one of the things that perhaps, and I don't know how much people knew about this, she had a very close friend in her house, a man
Charles Graves.
Charles Graves.
Yes.
And he had been bombed out, and he was a tenant there, and everyone knew him as a tenant there. He was a tremendous support to me, because I worked in the house. And Eva could be very brusque and completely oblivious of what she was demanding. If she was enthusiastic about something, you know, she would just expect one to give up everything, lay down tools, and just go ahead, you see. And while she was extremely tolerant, she was most tolerant of anyone's private life and accepting, she wasn't tolerant of anyone who wasn't prepared to dedicate themselves. Well, I happened to be someone who enjoyed working with her, and that worked very well. But there were times when she could be extremely demanding, and Charles was a great help. And
he'd say, what he'd say, "Oh, she's in that sort of mood."
That's
she?
Right,
that
yes.
Sort of thing. Yes, I see.
Now, it happened after I'd been working there for about a year or a year and a half that Eva was away on holiday. No, not on holiday, sorry. She was away giving some lectures. And also I remember she was to bring back a kitten from a colleague or something like that. And Charles got a cold, nothing that seemed very serious. And I was alone in the house during the day with him and with a very inept, stupid housekeeper. She had a series of housekeepers, I'm sure you've been told about
did
that.
Did she? I didn't hear that, actually.
And, you know, since she didn't, I don't believe she could cook.
I don't think she could. No, I think I heard that.
And certainly she, you know, left everything to the housekeepers so that when, you know, it was all... a question of luck, whether... I was alone with this housekeeper who was extremely inept, and for some reason which I will never understand, I decided to stay the night that night. It was not my custom to stay the night. And I stayed the night, and the next morning Charles had a heart attack. Mm. And I was very frightened. I was a young girl at that point. I mean, I think I was about 25, 26. And I sent for the doctor, and Charles never became unconscious. He lay there groaning, and asking all the time what the time was. And the doctor came and was playing tennis, I remember, and came and said, well, I'll give him some morphia. I'll come back later, but I should ring up any relatives. And I tried to ring Eva. By this time he was in such agony and he looked so terrible that it was frightening to be alone with him.
Yes, must have been that.
And I tried to get hold of her and I couldn't get hold of her anywhere, and he died. And I was alone at that time in the house, and eventually I got hold of Eva and said that Charles had died, and she came back armed with a kitten and all the rest of it. And then she told me that they had been lovers and had been living together and that no one knew. Now, I don't know whether this is something that is known.
I didn't know that at all, actually. Mm. I knew that Charles Grace was in the house and was looked after, and I thought it was a bit of good works, you know, how she surrounded people with...
They were lovers, and this was a very important factor in her life.
I know she was extremely depressed after he died, yes. I know that.
Yes. And then she was very, very angry with me and said, next time this happens, get hold of me. You know, I mean,
too late.
But, I mean, there was no address or anything to get. And I had really rung her everywhere. But this sort of way of speaking was very typical of her.
Mm. You mean very practical and sort of...
Well, no, almost
definite.
Oblivious of... I mean, she loved him, lived with him. Mm. And then she would say, next time it happens.
Yes, you mean she wouldn't sort of see how other people saw what she was saying. She wouldn't understand how it appeared to other people.
Well, and also, I mean, it was a defence against the depth of her emotion.
Yes, I see.
I mean, And then after that she said to me, you know, I'll have to work terribly hard to try and forget this. And she buried herself more than ever in work. But... she did speak to me quite a lot about her relationship with him and what it had meant to her. And in this connection, she told me about her husband and how lonely she had been. And a very feminine and warm side of her came out.
It's really splendid of you to tell me this, because even if one doesn't make use of it, one won't make mistakes in interpreting her if one knows this background, even if one doesn't even refer to it, you know.
I don't know to what extent. I'm sure her daughters knew about this.
Maybe they do, but they probably wouldn't want to tell me, you know, as a stranger about it. Why is it important, actually, do you think, for anyone to understand Eva's public work to know this? I mean,
because
important was he? In what way was he important?
You see, first of all, I think it was very important to know that she was a woman, essentially. Mm. And she didn't, to me, when she had grown-up children, appear to have much empathy or understanding with femininity, with her children's needs. I did feel, for example, that she was concerned about her children, but there was never
it wasn't
the same...
a very close relationship somehow.
Well, I think there was a close relationship, but you know how you hear mothers talking about their children and their marriages and their grandchildren and this sort of thing. Mm. There was never quite this degree of... I know she was worried about Rachel's deafness, and she was worried about Rachel... not marrying. Now, I should tell you that she introduced me to Rachel when I had to leave, and Rachel was living in Warwickshire and working in Warwickshire, and Rachel and I became very good friends, and this... It never meant... It's hard... I always had the feeling, as one does... You know, I worked with Madame Montessori.
Oh, yes.
I had the same experience, that these very brilliant women somehow... their children are an extension of themselves, and they can't enjoy their children's development in the same way as... perhaps the ordinary mother can, who feels proud of their children becoming what they become.
Yes.
Enjoys them separating and becoming someone in their own right.
Mm.
Rachel, for example, had a lot to contend with.
Is she like a lot of daughters of people active in the women's movement, that is, they have to fight to establish any individuality for themselves, or did she not, in fact, want to fight? Was that the difficulty with Rachel?
Rachel?
Hmm.
Well, I wouldn't like to say that. I think Rachel did fight and did have children. You know, she adopted her two children, and I think her mother was very pleased that she was going to.
I didn't know she'd done that. She adopted two children, Rachel.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Well, you see, I'm wondering how much of this, if you've interviewed. You see, Rachel adopted two children. Rachel very much wanted to marry, but felt she never would with her deafness.
Mm.
And so she adopted two children of her own.
I see.
And since she came from this very, this family where there were really so many people who would support her, there was no difficulty about this.
I see, yes. Because one of the things that they have said to me about Eva was that she had a... a very difficult life in many ways, in the sense of not being well off and having three children's support and all that, but she always had the security behind her that she had this rather wealthy and very warm sort of Jewish family behind her, which she could, if necessary, turn to.
I think that this was true, and yet you never felt any sort of... I myself am an agnostic, and I must say you never felt the... any sort of allegiance to any sort of racial or religious background at all.
No, I mean, I think this was just presented to me as a family thing.
It is true, of course, and it also gave her a sense of armchair socialism, if you know what I mean, because she lived, in spite of this talk about not being very well-to-do, she lived an extremely comfortable life. She had two cottages. And she had this lovely house and a large family whom I don't think... I mean, I think that her public life really did matter a very great deal to her. I'm not underestimating her family, but her public life really was terribly important to her.
Because she believed in these causes, but also because it was a way of dealing with her personal problems.
You see, I've never really believed that our interest in our causes is something entirely intellectual. And I think Eva would be a very good example of this, that somewhere or other something didn't satisfy her. She wasn't getting the sort of fulfillment. And she got the fulfillment from the public life and the working for causes and ideals, which she did with very great verve. She was not, I mean, you are speaking to Mr. Cottrell, who must be quite ancient now, and he's an unmarried man, isn't he?
You see, I don't know anything about him, except
I'm very interested. Do give him my love.
I certainly will, yes.
He'll know
yes.
me as Prince.
Yes.
And then there was a charming secretary there at Morley College, whose name I've forgotten. And then, of course, there were Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears, who were very important.
Yes, and Holst, of course.
Yeah, and Holst, yes. And,
but
going back to your question about this, I've never known what her childhood was like and what it was that drove her to this sort of way of life. But you see, it wasn't that she was a brilliant administrator. And I have never seen her as a brilliant administrator. There was a certain haphazardness about her. But it was made up for by this very great concern and an ability at the same time, you see, to allow you as much rope as was compatible with her own needs. I mean, when I say this, I really mean it, because there were certain points beyond which she could be quite unreasonable. And I'm sure that's come out in...
You mean she would insist on retaining control of some things?
Not even retaining control, but she wouldn't be able to see certain things.
Mm.
Whereas, in fact, she gave a tremendous amount of rope.
Mm.
And one of the things she did for me was this, that my husband was in the army at that point, so all the lectures that she could allocate to me that were anywhere near him. She did, you see, and then I could travel around and...
She was very thoughtful, wasn't she, about people who worked for her? I mean, this from Erna Nelke. She would think, she would be interested in your personal problems, if you had any, and would talk to you about them in a very sympathetic way. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I mean, you could always speak to her. She was accessible. Mm. She was thoughtful. She was concerned. And yet this went together with a certain remoteness. And it's an interesting contradiction, because she was very much inward-looking in some way, and remote. And there was a certain effort in relating. Mm.
Was this partly because she was so busy that she had to make time to deal with these personal problems, and she rather self-consciously made time rather than wanting to do it?
I would put it a different way. I would say that there was a need to be busy all the time, a need to keep herself continuously occupied.
Yeah. And this before Charles Grave died,
yes. Mm. Mind you, she could enjoy her holidays tremendously. And as I wrote to you, one of the things that we did together a lot, apart from breaking off suddenly and saying, let's go for a walk on the heath now, when we would talk about books or political movements or ways and means of getting family allowances onto the map, you know, which was very much close to her heart at that time. We ran these courses in shelters for people during the war.
What were these courses actually?
Well, mostly education for citizenship, but she did sponsor anything that people wanted to do, like painting and the rest of it, and she opened up I think one shelter that she was particularly interested in was Lambeth Bridge.
This was certainly seizing the opportunity, wasn't it? I mean, just educating people wherever you can, wherever it's convenient.
Yes. And, you know, we would walk through the raids to these shelters. And as I said, Eva wore a helmet. But as long as she was wearing the helmet, I felt completely safe. You know, she was an incredible power. You felt if you trotted along beside her, you see, that nothing could happen to you. She was quite immortal.
That's most interesting, because, you see, that rang a bell at once with me when you said that in your letter, because, you see, Erna Nelke said, when she died, I felt my great defender had gone. Mm. Something like that. Because Erna was...